and it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and said, we're not alone.
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
And welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. And we have a great one lined up for you tonight. We have both Alejandro Rojas, who is live with us tonight. He is on. Also, we have Ted Rowe, and he is the executive director of NARCAP. It's going to be a real interesting show. This is our first Google Hangouts. Thus, of course, we had technical problems. The chat room is not working on podcastufo.com. But it will be next week. We'll get that figured out. Unfortunately, I couldn't get a hold of the person that helps out with that at short notice. So please jump over to YouTube if you're watching on podcastufo.com if you want to get into the chat room there. So we are live streaming. Also, we have a new show coming up, the first new show, and it's called the Everything Else Show. That is coming up on March 27th with Paul and Ben Eno. Everything You Know Is Wrong, that's what they're going to talk about. Not just paranormal we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about everything else. And that includes whistleblowers. I have a CIA whistleblower on. I have Edward C. May. He was part of the Stargate project, remote viewing and all that. He's going to be on. So is Steve Callahan, who was a person that was shipwrecked and adrift for 70 days. I'm just going to try to talk to interesting people. I also know a lot of L.A. comedians. I'm going to be talking to a couple of those. It's a variety show. That's what it is. So looking forward tonight. I want to thank everyone that supports the show. If you'd like to help us out for $2 or more a month, you can go right to podcastufo.com and all that information is there. So I'm going to welcome both of you on at the same time. I'm really excited. One more thing. I am going to be at the UFO Congress next week out in Phoenix. If you're going to be there, a number of people have reached out to me, and I'd love to hang out with you. My email address is martin@podcastufo.com. And please get a hold of me. I'd like to meet up with you. It's going to be a lot of fun. And these two gentlemen that are on right now are going to be there. Also, one more thing. As we get into the show later on, if someone in watching on YouTube wants to join in and ask the guests a question, you'll be able to just put your Gmail email in the chat room and say that you want to join in. I will send you an invite so you can ask our guest directly a question that way. So, Alejandro Rojas, how are you doing? And welcome, Ted Rowe.
Greetings, aloha. Happy to be here.
Hello, I'm doing well.
And you know what I was? You can't get your camera to work.
I know. So I just hooked up my GoPro. Let's see if I can get this working, because so people
just
can
don't
see.
Wear it on your head and look around. You know, I mean, that's what you do with
GoPro. What's cool about my room is I have this nice artwork up that's made by Dale Hendrickson, who is actually someone I've talked about before because he does artwork with The Simpsons, and it's awesome artwork. And he's someone who always comes to the conference. He'll be there again, but he just is, besides being a super cool guy, he has some amazing artwork. And that's what I would have loved to have shown your audience, but I don't know if that's going to happen.
Well, someone just commented in the chat room, I have Japanese screens behind me, and I moved my studio. I've been trying to get rid of the static problem, so I've tried everything, bought new equipment, and finally, I just moved into my guest house, and we'll see if there's any static tonight. I hope not. Mm-hmm. But trying everything.
You know, there's something else I was thinking of, too, while you were talking. What would be interesting, you talked about how, you know, the Enos, and they do the Everything You Know Is Wrong type of thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of people do that, but I've never heard of a everything you know is right. Wouldn't that be interesting? That everything you think about life is exactly right. You are on spot on.
I would go into politics. That's what we would call it. I would spot go into on. Politics, Alejandro, but I'm not going to touch that. But I do want to read this one tweet that I just read. Okay. This was a tweet to Trump. It says, one thing that's sad, hopefully we'll have time to appreciate it later, is that there's definitely no UFOs, or Trump would have tweeted something. So anyway, I thought that was I don't want to get a lot of backlash from Trump supporters out there. I'm not saying one thing one way or the other. I'm just putting it out there. That was a tweet.
He would have tweeted about UFOs. He actually has tweeted about UFOs. I can't remember exactly what he said, but it was somewhat dismissive. It wasn't like UFOs are real or anything. But yeah, that gets into a whole other thing, which is something Ben Hance is going to be kind of covering some presidential stuff at our conference. And it gets me thinking, though, around, you know, the strategy that Hillary's campaign had, which was to tackle the UFO issue and to talk about it. And I kind of feel like she did that to kind of get, for lack of a more PC term, and this is a group of people who don't like PC anyway, so they should not be offended, but kind of the Billy Bob crowd, you know, those Trumpers that I think they were trying to appeal to them with a conspiracy sort of thing that isn't as hardcore as some of the other conspiracies like you see on Alex Jones or something. And I think that the UFO thing was their outreach to that group. And the reason Trump didn't touch it is that he really didn't want to disenfranchise the UFO crowd. So he just didn't speak to it at all, which is probably a wise move on his part, because the Trumpers possibly – who knows? We don't have enough statistics around it, but those are the type of people who may be even more prone to, you know, believing in UFO conspiracies. So I don't know, just some thoughts, because I was talking with Ben this weekend, and I think we'll have a lot of this. You know, Ted Rowe is going to be on a panel about government files, and I want to discuss some of this because I'm really trying to understand what assuming there was a strategy, which I'm sure there was, why did Hillary's campaign go there? Did it help or did it hinder? And then why did Trump not jump in? Because a lot of people intuitively felt that that was some low-hanging fruit. He really could have made fun of her if he would have jumped in and said, oh, you know, Hillary's talking about UFOs and aliens. You can't take her serious.
Right. Yeah. So, hey, do we have any, besides the UFO Congress coming up, which I am really, really excited about, is there anything that's happening in the skies?
Yeah, so we do have a couple of Roger Marsh stories recently that are somewhat interesting. So in New Hampshire, there was a video that was taken that is somewhat interesting, and it has some people talking. And this is a video from April 21st, 2016, it was taken at 7 p.m. So this is kind of in the summertime, so it's still light out. And the witness was, you know, sees jets all the time, but there was a light kind of following one of a jet. And they thought, you know, it was kind of weird. And the closer they looked, they could tell it was not a helicopter. And they videotaped it for a few seconds, and that videotape is pretty interesting. You do see a plane with a contrail, and then right above it, you see another object moving at a similar speed and in about the same direction with no contrail. And it almost seems larger, and it's not obviously an aircraft. Now, it could be. Of course, you know, getting people like Ted to look at it would be interesting. It could be just some people had suggested maybe it's an aircraft that is just outside of the contrail zone. So its exhaust is not creating a contrail. It also could be much closer than the other plane. So it's difficult to tell distances. But it is a really odd video. Of course, there's always a possibility of CGI. Which this could also be. Mm-hmm. So it's being investigated by New Hampshire MUFON. And so they have not finished their investigation yet. But it is an interesting video. It's not obviously CGI. But, yeah, it sounds like you're looking at it right now.
No, not me. It could be Ted is in his car for the listening audience. He's in Hawaii, and he's sitting in his car out in a town not too far away from volcano. So who knows? That could have been a volcano in the background. I'm not sure.
It so really could be a volcano?
No, I think you'd see him skedaddle.
You would be looking at empty camera space, definitely.
You'd be running.
We get earthquakes, you know, pretty steadily up the mountain, and the lava kind of comes and goes, and it glows at night, and it's pretty primal, you know.
Wow.
Pay attention.
I'm going to be taking my first. We just booked my very first trip to Hawaii. A lot of my family's been there. My girlfriend's been there. Everybody loves it. I have a friend out there. I can't remember where he's at. We're going to be in Waikiki, actually. So I am just extremely excited about it.
Wonderful.
Well, hey, side note.
That sounds like a good time.
Before I forget, I just wanted to say a shout out to last week. We had a guest cancel just a few minutes before the show, and we had Donnie Goslin, who sat in. He was a retired police officer. And I just want to say a special thanks to him. We made it through the whole 2 hours. He did a great job. A number of people have written me saying that, you know, he knows so much about the UFO topic, even more than some people that are in the field, you know? So it was pretty good.
Mm. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I'm glad that worked out. And also, just another thing, I'm going to be doing a roundtable again at the UFO Congress. So hopefully that'll be a lot of fun. I have a camera coming, so I should have a nice clean video during that as well. So that'll be live here 1 week from today. I can't believe it's already coming up.
So yeah. I do have one more story.
You mean I interrupted you? Go ahead.
Oh, no, that's okay. Sorry, we're kind of all over the place today. But so this is another interesting one. Now, this is one where you have to take witness testimony because the images are interesting given the testimony, but stand alone, as so many images do on their own. You know, you can't tell what's going on. But essentially, you can see through the woods in between these homes a bright light. This is in Idaho Falls, and this light supposedly flew over the home. And in one of the images, the light is streaking. However, of course, with a solid light, if you move the camera, it's going to look like it's streaking. This picture was taken only recently in February 5th. But, given the testimony, they said there were a couple people. This object passed over the house and was in a sphere shape, but it looked like it morphed into more of a kind of a longer sort of shape. And they said that it was very silent, and that their quote was, the sound had deadened around them. So for some reason, there were no birds. It just got very, very quiet as this object went by. So this is another odd one, actually, given the photos, because it looks like a very, very bright object. Now, if you had the photos by themselves, you might say it could be Venus, you know, that is out there, or perhaps a light on a light post off in the distance, because there's not a lot of context in all of the pictures. But given the testimony, if this thing was something that flew over the home, it's very bright. So, this is another interesting case.
Wow, wonderful. Well, is there any last thing you'd like to say, Alejandro, to the people about next week or anything? Anything change or anything? Go ahead.
Oh, changes. There has been a change. So Jennifer Stein is not going to be able to make it. She was going to talk about crop circles. She won an award last year for a documentary she made on Travis Walton. Mm-hmm. And it is a great documentary. It's got more witnesses you know, in it than anything out there. However, unfortunately, she had a family emergency, so she can't make it. So Travis is actually going to speak instead, and he does have something new. A lot of people say, well, you know, I've seen him talk, and it's great, but I've heard it all. But he wants to talk about something new. So he wants to talk about the credibility factor, which ought to be interesting coming from him. So essentially how people have reacted to his case, how the media has reacted then versus now, and kind of how that brings up credibility issues, not with just his case and how he feels his case is credible, but what makes a case credible or not credible. So from his perspective, I think that'll be pretty interesting. And he'll be doing that talk on the first day. Also, there's a lot of news right now about Tom DeLonge and his nonfiction books coming out, the first one coming out in March. And he is supposed to, and this is, I really haven't talked about this much, so he's supposed to be providing some sort of groundbreaking information to us that we'll be able to share at the conference. You'll hear it first at the conference, but of course, we're a news organization. We don't hold on to info. It's all about getting it out there. So we'll share it with the general public soon after we share it with the conference goers. So that ought to be interesting.
Wow. I hope he does on the first day so I can say something at the hangout
next
week. It won't
be. I'll tell you when it'll be. It won't be until Saturday, assuming it happens, because we haven't gotten it yet. But it'll happen Saturday evening at the banquet.
Okay. Now, the thing about Travis, I've talked to him many times, you know, off mic, and he's very intelligent. And also,
he is.
He has some great perspectives. I did an interview one time, and I said, I'm going to do an interview with you and not talk about your case at all. Talk about everything else. And it was actually really, really good. He's really a fascinating guy. And he has a, you know, of course, he has a perspective different than most people could possibly have.
Mm-hmm. I agree. He's very quiet. Mm-hmm. But when you really start getting him to talk about some of these topics, you find that he's actually, you know, given all of these things a lot of thought. And he's an honest, kind of heartfelt person. So you see this is kind of, he's thinking, you know, there's no filter there. Or it doesn't feel like there's any, you know, any filter as far as ego and stuff like that. It's all about thinking about the phenomena.
Right.
And how it affects people.
That's right. Well, you all set. Thanks so much, Alejandro.
No problem. Thank you. I look forward to seeing you both. You don't know how excited I am to see both of you, and so happy you're going to be part of the conference, Ted. I've always, you know, been excited, and I get kind of hesitant to approach you and Dr. Haynes because I know how serious you are with your research and how careful you are, just like Leslie Kane is with the venues that they approach. So very honored that you're going to be. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking very much forward to being there and sharing with you and your crew some things that nobody's heard before. I've got a story to tell. So
great.
Awesome. To it.
All right, Alejandro, thanks so
much. All right. Yep, we'll see you guys soon.
All right.
Okay,
see you in a few days. Yep. Okay, so Ted Rowe, he is the co-founder and the executive director of NARCAP, which actually stands for the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena, and established back in 1999. So, Ted, again, welcome to the show. Great to have you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Martin. I look forward to it.
And, you know, we have questions rolling in already, and I just looked a few minutes ago. We have a whole slew of questions up on our forum for you as well. And I'm not sure how many questions we're going to get to, but first of all, I'd like to talk, before we get into the topic of NARCAP, I'd like for the listening audience and watching audience, actually, to know a little bit about you. Can you give us your background and what made you actually get interested in this topic to start with?
Well, I came into UAP studies, honestly enough, from personal experience. It started when I was a kid, and I'd seen some things. And as I got older, I continued to see things from time to time. And and eventually I saw something and I contacted NASA at NASA Ames Research Center, and Dr. Haynes came back to me. Oh. And I discussed the case with him and went through an investigative process, and somewhere in that he invited me to help him set up this reporting center. And I've done that, and we've run it together for the last 17 years.
Now, how did that, was that his brainchild, the whole thing?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, he was heading towards retirement. He was looking for a project. And originally, the scope was international. We talked about it and scaled it back a little bit, and then went ahead with a basic business development, trying to get the process to work. Of course, it's a new idea, and getting it to work is challenging. It always was.
I had met Dr. Haynes down in North Carolina, I think it was like 3 years ago, really had some great conversations with him. And he wasn't really excited to be on the show because of the name of the show being UFO Podcast UFO. And sure. I want to talk to you a little bit about that, but I want to make sure I don't forget that. I'm making a note. But if you go ahead and continue about your background, and did you have any science background at all yourself, or is it just administrative?
It was administrative primarily, but I grew up in an aviation household. My dad was an air traffic controller in Great Falls, Montana. I grew up there in the 60s, right? He was dual rated for Great Falls International and Malmstrom, and I was around aircraft all my life. But it was my administrative help that Dr. Haynes was looking for. And so that was my contribution primarily.
Yeah.
In the process, I learned quite a lot about research and ended up writing some papers of my own. But that was all under mentorship, you know, mm-hmm. from Dr. Haynes and others.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said you've written some papers. Has anything ever been published out of NICAP, NARCAP?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, we published on our own site, but generally speaking, there is no authoritative source for publication for UAP. Used to be Journal of UFO Studies, but there's really not a lot out there right now. Mm-hmm. That's something I'm looking to remedy, in fact.
Oh, good. Oh, good. So you started in 1999. And
yes.
How was it immediately accepted? And did you actually have to do a lot of outreach to, aviation groups and things like that? How'd the ball get rolling on this?
Well, we had some help. Of course, Dick worked at Ames Research Center, and they have an aviation safety research office there. And the director there was a friend of Dr. Haynes and had a high interest in what we were doing. We ended up, through his help, briefing the FAA's aviation safety reporting system analysts at a bunker there at Battelle. And then, and we're just kind of leaked out. We let it grow organically. We didn't push too hard because the subject is tricky. It's difficult for pilots and air controllers. There's a perceived risk in discussing these things or reporting them.
Now, is that the same for every airline, or is it airline per airline?
That's a very good question. And what we learned, we actually did an aircrew survey project, and we went to different airlines and asked to put this survey in their ready rooms. And a number of refused us, and then one or two accepted. So it seems to me that it's institutional. It's not industry-wide as far as difficulties around the subject.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of friends that are pilots, and I spoke to one and asked him if he had ever seen anything, and he flies international. He said he himself has never seen anything, but he does know other pilots, and they don't talk about it. And so I asked him, I tried to get a hold of him before this show, but I wasn't able to, but I did ask him at that time if those pilots reported it. He didn't know, but it's does every, I don't want to say every pilot, do most pilots know that they have a place to go to report something?
Not at this point. No, it's word of mouth. And, we've done some promotion, of course, with NARCAP and let it grow organically, but the FAA is, if you go to their manual, if a pilot can't identify, something that he's concerned about, they don't, they refer him away from the FAA. They're not interested in his information. The only way he can get it into the FAA system is through the ASRS, which is a confidential, non-punitive reporting system.
Really? Okay. And why do you think that? Is it just threatening to them because it can't be identified? Why would you think the FAA keeps that as taboo or out of the system?
Well, you know, that's a good question. There was all kinds of protocols around handling unidentifieds through the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. GenEp, 126, Service communication information for reporting visual importance items, this kind of stuff. A pilot could be fined or imprisoned for talking about what he might see in the air. They were using them for forward observers. No. They were using them for forward observers to see the Russian bombers coming over the pole and this sort of thing. So pilots in the air were technically forward observers. And as such, they couldn't talk about what they'd seen. And a lot of them didn't like that. You know, there was some definite rebellion against that regime. But that it had a chilling effect that continued into the 70s and 80s. And I think it's in management now. Mm-hmm. They just don't talk about it much. You know, some do. Mostly don't. You need now, to get them in a safe environment.
Yes, right. I understand that. Now, is there any such thing as a NARCAP looking into historical cases, or do they just stay with contemporary reports?
Well, of course, primarily we're looking for fresh cases, but mm-hmm. we do collect historical cases. I hand them over to Dick. Or if he receives them, he takes them and puts them in his AirCat. It's called Air Catalog, which is a case file he's put together of about 3,400 aviation cases involving incidents or observations that seem to be related to UAP or unidentified aerial phenomena, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
So we collect them, but if they're not current, we don't devote a lot of resources to them unless they're just really juicy, unless there's just a lot of information available.
Does it also depend on, let's say, if there's not a lot going on, like you may want to dip into something from the past or something like that, or do you just keep the channels open for anything that may happen?
Well, we keep the channels open, but there's plenty of chatter. People are talking. We have international technical specialists and research associates that are writing papers that are peripheral to our study. We're learning about UAP cases in other countries as specialists step forward and offer their historical sort of compendiums of UAP-related events that might be aviation-related in their countries. And we've been collecting some of these. We've heard from Argentina. We've heard from Czechoslovakia, I think. It's developing, you know.
Yeah.
These things happen everywhere, near as I can tell. So.
Now, what about helicopter? Do you do any helicopter pilot reports?
Oh, sure. I wrote a paper for a project we did with NARCAP called Project Sphere, and I wrote the U.S. section on it. I did a study of 120 aviation cases that seemed to involve unidentifieds, and there was helicopters in that in the breakdown and all that. There were helicopters. There were military transport, military fire aircraft. I broke it all down. Commercial aircraft, private aircraft, civil aviation.
Tell me a little bit more. Tell us a little bit more about this Project Sphere, please.
Well, Project Sphere, we took the model off of the Condyne report, mm-hmm. which was the report by the British Ministry of Defense. It was a comprehensive study. Not the best study. They painted with a broad brush, but they hit a number of different aspects of the UAP phenomena. They looked at microwave effects. They looked at influence on cars. They looked at influence on human beings. They looked at sightings and pilot reports. They looked at different aspects of it, and then they considered the phenomenon as it presented and tried to come up with some sort of coherent theory, which I don't stand behind, but I thought the model was good. And so we went after spherical UAP. Dr. Haynes had been working on this for a while. So we started doing, we did a study on spherical UAP. We broke down, we studied them by geometry. We studied them by radar cross-section. We studied them by by the way they're reported. We studied them by photographs. We compiled there were about 15 of us involved, and we wrote about 22 papers, and that all falls under Project Sphere on the NARCAF website.
Okay, would you say that some of these spheres appear to be under intelligent control?
It's hard to argue either way. But, you know,
are there some cases in particular?
Well, we have one on our site, NARCAP Technical Report 12, and it involves some astronomers who were on the ridge on San Bruno between the ocean and on the coastal ridge between the ocean and San Jose Airport. And an airliner was coming in. They had a pretty good camera at the time. It was 8 megapixel. It was 2005, I think. And they saw a small light following the aircraft. And so they started shooting a sequence of pictures. And at one point, this little ball of light pulls up under the tail of the aircraft and holds position for a little bit and then breaks away at an oblique angle. And I don't know how to write a paper that describes a ball of light behaving intelligently, but, you know, there are attributes there that need to be looked at. I don't think that we should throw the baby out with the bathwater. We want to be careful.
Right. Now, what is the relationship between these spheres and the Foo Fighter reportings during World War II?
My guess is that it's the same phenomenon, but that's a guess. I mean, the difference between, you know, guessing that and knowing it. I mean, are the orange balls of light that pilots see at altitude the same one that Earthlights people see on the ground? You know, I don't know how to connect that. You know, what kind of study would actually validate that?
All right. So let's go into, I haven't even looked at any of these questions yet, but let's go into what happens once a pilot reports a sighting. How does it, you said it goes to Richard first?
Yeah. So basically, if it comes to me, I hand it off to him. It'll show up in my email or his, or it'll show up in our snail mail. And, We reach out to them. We find out how sensitive they are to confidentiality. We treat it as if it's going to be confidential, and we do a full investigation as fully as we can, and then we'll de-identify the case, and unless in the rare situation they want to be related to it, and then it becomes a white paper, and we publish that.
I see.
That's the short path.
Uh huh. Are there some? Are most cases? I don't want to say most cases. Is there a majority of cases that you figure out some type of natural phenomena that happened? I heard you say Earthlights, like sprites, or there's ball lightning. There's all kinds of natural phenomena that you might be able to observe from the skies.
Yes, and we look very carefully at all these possibilities. Dr. Haynes is a perceptual psychologist, an expert in visual acuity and expert reflections, this sort of thing, and very helpful in breaking down illusions that pilots are susceptible to and what's left.
And why would they? Can you go into why pilots would be susceptible to illusions? What type of illusions?
The same reason all of us are. For example, if you were to sit in a very dark room, and to have a single point light source, a small one, like an incense stick, just the little glow on the end of the incense stick. And if you sit that very still on the other side of the room in the dark, and you sit still and you look at that, it'll start moving. You'll see it vibrate, boom, 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 boom. And it's vibrating with your heartbeat. It's called autokinesis. And it can fool people. They think the light's moving, but it's their eyeball that's moving. Okay, and that's one type of illusion that a pilot can be, or a delusion that a pilot can be susceptible to. There's a lot of stories of pilots flying into the ground or nearly hitting intersections where there's red and green lights, thinking they're following aircraft into the on a pattern.
Wow!
And they're flying visually, so they're not looking at their instruments when they should be flying instrument, not looking out their window. You know, so there's different things that can happen that can explain some types of observations and incidents. And there are others where they go right ahead and make reports and file them with NTSB and wait for nothing. Basically, nobody can resolve it. But they were frightened enough or concerned enough. Souls they felt were in danger. So they made a report, you know. And the kind of reports we get are like loss of separation, near mid-air collisions, dynamic passes around the aircraft, this kind of thing. So it's active enough that it makes people nervous, makes pilots nervous.
I bet. Someone wanted to know, how does NARCAP, is it a nonprofit or how is it funded?
Well, NARCAP is a nonprofit. We're 501c3 registered. Generally, ideally, we run on a standard funding drive program where we manage memberships and take donations in that fashion. But more or less, we run it out of our own pockets. We don't really pick up that much funding. And we haven't had any really ambitious funding attempts out there. The kind of work we do, we can pretty well manage on our own. And it's kept us from being beholden to anybody, which has been part of my motivation for not seeking big money donors.
Yes, right, right. Yes, I heard you talk on another podcast where Bigelow at one time wanted to buy some files. You could have the copies, but he wanted the originals, and you vetoed that whole idea, which I thought was a pretty good idea.
Well, I didn't veto it, but I advised Dr. Haynes strongly that wasn't the path to take, and he agreed with me. Those materials are Dick's. He's worked very hard putting them all together, and it's really his call what he does with them. And my understanding is that he's turning 80 this year, and he's signing his papers over to a university in the South, I believe, in Arkansas.
Wow. Wow, he didn't look 80 when I saw him. Wow, that's amazing. well, yeah. 77, that is, at the time. So yeah. There's no actual office. You're spread. How many people are involved in NARCAP?
Well, we're a virtual organization. We have approximately 50 members in NARCAP US, which includes technical specialists, international technical specialists, research associates. And then we have an international branch in Germany that Hillebrand von Ludwiger is running, the guy that has MUFON CES. We're in the process of sort of consolidating a NARCAP there. I believe he's got a dozen or more members of his own. Don Ledger manages NARCAP Canada for us. Mm-hmm. And
Doug Harbor, right?
Yeah, right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that's kind of our primary situation. We have some official research agreements with the government of Chile and their team and some other agreements with different associations that also help.
I became a pretty good friends with Jose Lai from Cefaha. And unfortunately, I had him and Leslie lined up recently for a show. And I said to Leslie, I was contacted by someone to take a look at Mick. I'm trying to remember what he is. Metabunk. I just forgot his last name. So anyway, I said, I think we better cancel the show. I told Leslie until we really look into this this helicopter sighting with the infrared camera. Were you involved in any type of way with that?
No, I wasn't. And it's kind of unfortunate that whole situation,
right?
Because peer review, you know, established standards for review and publication, so that partners can be involved and that missteps might be mitigated. I reached out fairly early in our relationship with Cefaha to try and establish some of this and wasn't very successful. And I haven't been the biggest booster in terms of maintaining relationships that aren't healthy for us. A lot of my team think, well, it's better to have it than not. And well, maybe yes, maybe no. The main thing is that are you a team? Are we working together? If we are working together, then the things you say and the things you do influence our image and affect the things we're trying to say. So how do we do this in a way that's safe for all of us and that we can move our message together to make this happen? And so far, I haven't really found that inroad with Cefaha to make that function really occur. There's been a couple of situations that have arisen that have made me very nervous as an administrator. And of course, I bounced this off the advisory committee and off of Dr. Haynes. And I think, of course, it's my job to think I'm right, but some of these things need to be dealt with properly. And there's a reason that these guys are research scientists and not businessmen and not salesmen, you know.
Well, I think what you, NARCAP, is doing is, you know, using a lot of science, trying to really look at things logically, keeping your side of the road clean, and just doing, you know, really the best that you can do. Why can't a government agency do the same thing? You just told me you're virtual, you have a virtual office, you have 50 or so people spread around. Understand the cost for some type of similar agency shouldn't be too high at all, and I just wonder why more governments aren't doing.
Well, it's you know, Leslie Keynes brought this question up too.
Similar thing,
why this hasn't been championed more by the U.S. government, I don't really have a good answer for that. I know that behind the scenes, there's an interest in the subject and the phenomenon. It's just social conditions and the way people play out their fears in public. They don't want to be associated with this. It can affect their careers. It can affect their image, which is interesting because that's how I met Leslie, really, was at in Washington, D.C., briefing Representative Davis and other congressmen trying to manage an initiative to move information forward. That's how Podesta learned of the term UAP, was because we briefed him on it. Dr. Haynes came up with the original definition for unidentified aerial phenomena in 1980. And we decided in NARCAP that the term UFO wasn't accurate and it was a bit pejorative too. So we suggested that unidentified aerial phenomena was more accurate, and then we could say unidentified aerial phenomena / object or / light.
Wow. I wonder how Richard felt about Hillary Clinton using that word
it was a big thrill for all of us. I knew that Podesta's crew had been paying attention. We had we took several trips to Washington, D.C. Dr. Michio Kaku.
Oh, yeah.
Vetted a lot of the materials that we presented upline. Eventually, it ended up being a congressional hearing. But the Department of Homeland Security sort of skewed it away from the UFO, UAP thing into something less.
Now, have you ever had a conversation with him, Michio Kaku?
No, not directly. No. Well, with Dr. Kaku, yes.
Yeah, oh, you have.
Yeah, I spent most of an afternoon with him.
Did you ever get into the topic of UFOs with him?
Oh, yes. He was reviewing our materials to advise congressmen. Yes, we talked quite a lot about it. His impression was that he was looking at exogenous incursions. And he felt that it was appropriate to say that. And I think it, in a way, it kind of is, because there's a real trend to want to treat this all as a science problem, you know, science problem, right? We're going to solve this, and then we'll have the emphatic evidence that's so perfect to put our logical box together and explain who these guys are and what this is all about. It's actually a tactical problem. And by the time science gets around with all of that, we may be very far behind the eight ball. And if we suspect that these are exogenous incursions, then be vigilant. You know, maybe you can't prove it, but you know, we have Navy SEALs in action all around the world every week somewhere, blowing things up, taking pictures, whatever, you know. Where's the evidence? How much evidence do they leave behind, you know? And how much evidence do you expect an advanced culture that's capable of doing what some of these lights and objects are suggested to be able to do how much evidence does that leave behind? And are you setting the bar too high to defend yourself? You know, I'm running a research team, but I'm not a researcher. You know, I'm an experiencer, and I'm somebody who's looking at the whole picture here. And in my mind, if we want to take it seriously that these are exogenous incursions, then taking it seriously means being more vigilant, collecting better data, doing a better job of crunching that data, having enough information to fall back on in case it confirms that, yes, we are visited. Then we've got, you know, half a library of people's, of good, smart people thinking about it and they're writing to fall back on to help us try and deal with it. I can't say that any particular case that NARCAP has engaged has been indicative of an alien incursion, but we're having a lot of reports of this kind of thing going on, and it's not something you want to get wrong. I would rather we spent 50 years chasing shadows than not be in a proper footing if it actually happened. You can't defend the planet. So how vigilant should you be? You know, I think you should be very vigilant. You know, just be vigilant.
Yeah, I do too. You know, I've been doing this for a rather short time compared to a lot of people out there, but when I started this, I was thinking that, you know, I would know more, and I just realized that that's not really so. It just seems like there's so much to this. One thing, I have said this on my show a couple of times, and it was a guest that I had. He was a senior visiting scientist and astrophysicist at NASA. And he said that quietly, some of him and, his colleagues in conversations said or agreed on that if a civilization could get through the bottleneck of technology without blowing themselves up, they'd probably be traveling the stars and visiting other planets. Mm-hmm. This is someone that was at NASA. And, you know, I mean, it just seems that, you know, one of the issues that we have here is that it's not taken seriously. I know there's, you know, reasons for that, the ridicule factor, the Robertson panel, and different situations that caused that. Have you firsthand seen any of that, the ridicule part of the whole thing?
Oh, sure. I've lived it. I have a family, and half of them don't support me at all in this.
Really? Wow.
I pay a price for doing what I do, and I think a lot of us do. I think a lot of us were dedicated to engaging this, and we're trying to get to the other side of it without us, you know, trying to just get the answer. A lot of us pay a high price.
I'm going to ask you, do you feel the same way I do? Do you know any more about it since you started?
I came into it because I've seen things already. Mm-hmm. So it really didn't matter what I knew or what I didn't know. It was in my body. It's in my nervous system. I had trauma from it. I went through a whole journey of dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder, working it through, which led into freediving, which is one of my passions. And reawakened my training in Budo, you know, martial arts, Japanese Zen arts and Zen training, to the point where I was invited to teach at a Zen temple, teach Japanese sword. I went from an unawakened person, a person who wasn't self-aware enough and who was mystified by the idea of an alien presence, and particularly in love with the idea that I had some experience with what looked like that. And I thought I was special. I thought I knew something. I thought I had something to say. And I've come to learn that first off, I'm not special. These things probably shouldn't be happening to me or other people, and that it may not be a good situation, and that I need to choose my words carefully and choose my behavior carefully around it. I'm a carrier of information, one of a number of us in our society. And to do that correctly means I need to take it seriously And taking it seriously means getting yourself out of it, getting your opinion out of it. Just look at what's happening and don't make it about you. For me, for a long time, it was about me. Oh, God, it drove me. I was obsessed. Mm-hmm. I answered emails at 3 a.m. on Christmas, you know, for years. calling Dick every other day or two, dealing with my team and being paranoid and hypersensitive about things going right or wrong in my organization and all of it. And as I trained myself and followed the training laid out for all of us, I became more rational, less delusional, less self-absorbed, more open to information, more aware of what logic and rational understanding is and how to break down logical arguments to see whether they're specious or not. And it changed me considerably. It was like working on a mystery that you can never solve, but you hold the same standards and you tilt at it every day. And it turns you into something else.
Wow, interesting. Well, a few people in the chat room are obsessed with what's in your car. And I noticed it looks like a samurai sword handle right behind your shoulder there, the black handle.
Yeah, I'm teaching a class tonight. I teach Naido, which is Japanese sword. So I've got several of them in the car here.
And you have a dog. Did I see a dog's ear poke up a minute ago?
You certainly did. That's my good boy, Max.
Hey, Max, be a good dog. He's not barking.
He's crashed. No, we're letting him sleep.
There's a question in the forum. How does NARCAP differ from other UFO research organizations?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've been asking myself that for a while and asking myself, what is the point in research organizations per se? There's a real problem here. The cases get written up, the information gets developed, papers get written, and then nothing. And I know because I've published 40 papers myself of people like Massimo Teodorani and Dr. Haynes and Dr. Belie and others. We published their paper on our website. But what happens then? Mm-hmm. Nothing. Take it from me, nothing. Nothing happens. And in fact, people don't even read them. They say they read them. They say they look at them, but they don't read them. This is a problem because there's no authoritative source for UAP information for the science community. And I've taken on a project called the International Association of UAP Researchers. It's an organization I'm developing, and one of its primary goals is to develop a peer-reviewed journal for UAP research, for both historical research and scientific research, so that material can be vetted before it goes out. So that CEPHA, for example, if they comply with the rules and don't talk to anybody and submit their material to us, we can review it, right? And then that, now they've got a white paper instead of just a bundle of information they put out on the net. You know, so now there's a study and it can be referred to and can be argued with and sorted out, whichever way it goes. And that's severely lacking there.
I'm sorry. I think there was a little lag in the internet connection. They had 2 years. They reviewed that case for over 2 years before they came out with it. What do you think they should have done differently?
Well, you know, it's really interesting because first off, it's an aviation case, and they're sequestered in their director general of aviation. The CEPHA is in the Chilean Air Technical School. So they're surrounded by aviation experts. And IPACO, which is a research effort run by Francois Louanger and Antoine Cousins, did a study on this case. And I think it's the majority report. I think it was the correct report, and they did it within the year that CEPHA first ran into it. So I think the mistake... And I want to be very careful with our friends in Chile because they're motivated and they want to do the right thing. I know they do. But the mistake, I think, was not submitting it to peers and not having a standard and practices manual set up for how we manage information before we publish it. And I don't think they're clear inside their organization about how they do that. I know inside my own, it wasn't very clear either. But that makes or breaks a lot of organizations. You know, they put up something and they kill their credibility just like that.
Yes. Yeah, I've been concerned about that in this particular case, because that's actually the second time that this has happened. A similar thing happened. The other one was bugs. I don't know if you remember that one.
Yes, I do. And actually, we were part of that. And Dr. Haynes came back on the idea that it wasn't all bugs. I didn't do the research, but what I saw didn't look like a bug to me. But that's why we have majority and minority reports. The way these things should be done is that a comprehensive study should be done by the initiating party, CEFAA, right? It's in their lap, comprehensive study. And then they hand it out to several of their partners. And we do the same thing independently, don't talk to them. And then we all come back together and we look at all the variants in the studies and then decide which is the majority and which others are the minority. And then publish all of it. This is similar to peer review, for example, in Nature, Journal Science. A paper is written and then for 3 months, counter papers and counter arguments are submitted to the editor. And all of it gets published. And so you have this comprehensive block of information about these cases. I think that's the way to go. NTSB does it this way. Other good investigative organizations do it this way. That way you have all the information. You don't just take the majority report and ignore the rest of it. You have it all. TWA 800, for example, you're probably familiar with that.
Yes.
This case.
Shot down off of New York.
Exactly. Yeah. And mm-hmm.
Shot down. So it looked like it was shot down. They don't, you know.
Majority report said gas tank explosion. Minority report said missile strike. Mm-hmm. Both got published. Okay. They're all in the file on TWA 800. It's just the government said, we're not going to go with that one. We're going to go with this one. And maybe it may have been political, may have been accurate. I don't know. I'm not judging. But the point is, all the information is in the folder. It's all there. You know, so that's a comprehensive study versus just saying, okay, we got this video and we got this audio and we kind of talked about it and we're throwing it out as probably one of our best UAP cases out there. No white paper, no secondary studies, no checking with your buddies and your peers to see if we're all on the same page. And that's sort of a problem because everybody, it makes you seem like you want to be the one, you know, the one that cracks this whole thing open. You know, mm-hmm. And that's ego. That's very ego driven, and mm-hmm. It doesn't serve us at all. And frankly, I don't think there's a lot of cracking that needs to be done. This is part of, you know, reason I'm running an association of researchers coming up rather than just NARCAP as a research group is to what do you do with the information once you've got it? You know, and where does it go? And we need that. Ufology needs that. And I didn't want to be the person to do it. I've spent maybe 10 years talking to all kinds of people. Dr. Teodorani. I published one of his first papers in the United States. I found out that he had done the lead work at Hesselin with Erling Strand.
Oh,
they did a joint Italian-Norwegian study there and a couple of years of it. And he wrote some good papers. And I'd been visiting a site where anomalies were reported rather steadily, kind of a Hestelin here in North America. And I met Erling Strand there and got referrals to Dr. Teodorani and so on. So I published a lot of papers, you know, around this work. And but the influence of those papers is just nil. There's just nothing there. And that's the core problem. That's the core problem. As an administrator, when I look at this stuff, my scientists did what they should. You know, they wrote their papers. But you don't argue these things out in the comments section of social media. Mm. You know, you do this work. It's important to get an answer, right or wrong. And so I've been really trying to advocate that, trying to push that idea forward. And this organization I'm developing is along those lines. to make a peer-reviewed journal available, and to give researchers an extra sounding board and extra advisement on how to move their information in a way that science will look at it.
Can you think of any other type of situation where there's challenges like there is when it comes to UAP and UFO?
Well, there's other studies that are pretty similar. I'm not the first person to say it, but studying weather is a lot like studying UAP and UFO.
Because it's it's elusive, right? Is that what you mean?
You can't predict it. Yes, and you look for patterns, but that means documenting everything until something repeats. Hmm. And it may not repeat quite the same way. So there's a lot of watching and a lot of accumulating data and looking for patterns. And in some cases, the patterns are there and they're disturbing. So if we want to get somewhere with all of this, at some point, looking for patterns won't be enough. I think we've got a lot of cases. We've got enough cases to where something definitive could be said about exogenous incursions. I'm sure of that. We've got cases that quack like ducks, and we ignore them at our own peril. The Minot B-52 case, 1968. Tom Tulin did that study. Powerful case, radar data, gun camera photographs, gun radar photographs. Witnesses seeing a very large object with lights inside of it on the ground. Just all the things that would make you wonder if this was an exogenous incursion or not. And the Air Force came back and said it was the moon.
that's not really surprising. You hear about the Venus and, you know.
Oh, sure. You know, and the guys that really understand this are people like Jan Aldrich and Fran Ridge. These guys have been in the game since 1960, late 50s, as members of NICAP and ACRO and other organizations. They've seen a lot that we don't know about. And the Project 1947 thing, I think that's where Tom Tulin published his paper on the Minot B-52 case.
Well, that's it for the end of Hour One. Thanks so much for listening. And I have to tell you, if you've been thinking about subscribing, but you haven't pulled the trigger yet, this is the show to do it. Hour Two is amazing. He talks about an experience like I don't think I've ever heard before. Anyway, you can do that for $2 or more a month. That's on Podcast UFO. Next week, we will be doing the roundtable live stream at the UFO Congress. Real excited about that. I can't wait to get out of all this 2 feet of snow here. And thanks again for listening. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.